beverages. Mm-hmm. Hello, my name is Lewis. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is June 3rd, 2006. My home group is the Howard County Speakers Group, Tuesday nights, 8:30, Howard County, Maryland. It's near Columbia. We're a one-hour speaker meeting just like this, carrying a similar message to this meeting, I believe, of reliance upon God and service to others. And I have a sponsor who has taken me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've had the honor and the privilege of taking some men through the 12 steps as well. And I believe it is for those reasons, in combination with a relationship of a loving God, that I stand before you guys sober and happy tonight. And I think that's the kicker, is the happy part. I think there's a lot of ways to get sober. You tie a guy like me to a tree, I'll get sober. You know, the kicker is finding a way to get happy about it at the same time. And I believe that is what the tenets of Alcoholics Anonymous have afforded me, is a way of life that has allowed me to be happy right here, right now, in sobriety. I would like to thank Sam for asking me to speak this evening. So, hopefully, Sam asked me to speak. God's going to tell me what to say, so if I offend anyone, you guys can talk to one or two of them at some point. I thank you guys for welcoming me out here. You guys are just very, very kind, and I can look you all in the eye and see you guys are fired up and chasing this thing. It's always so nice to see people who are practicing the same primary purpose that I believe that I am, and are chasing this thing and are getting the results that I'm getting. It reinforces what I'm doing and reminds me why I'm here today. So thank you guys. I am not a first nighter. My sobriety date is in 2006. I came into AA in 1999, and I was in and out of these rooms for 7 years. And over the course of those 7 years, I figured out that there's nothing to figure out here. You know, I came into your rooms, and for 7 years, I drank your coffee, and I sat on your chairs, and I flirted with your fellowship, and I did nothing to change the man that I brought into these rooms. And I almost died for that arrogance. You know, and I hear you guys sitting in here talking about God, your spiritual solution, your spiritual awakenings, your higher powers. And I think to myself, that is insane. That is absolutely insane. I don't know about anyone else. When I first got here, you guys were a cult. You guys were nuts. I have this thing called alcoholism that the American Medical Association has dubbed a disease, a mental illness. And they have devised a treatment plan to treat this mental illness, okay? And that involves things like group therapies and medication and all sorts of psychiatric workout plans and meeting with specialists. I'm not knocking this stuff. This stuff helps a lot of people, you know, but there's all these treatment plans in place to treat alcoholism. That, to me, sounds like maybe a plausible treatment for alcoholism, you know, but also they tell me, you got to go to these AA meetings. You're an alcoholic. Your only chance, same exact thing that Carl Jung said to Roland Hazard 80-some years ago, your only chance of not dying of alcoholism is finding God. May you find him now. Good luck. You know, you are a hopeless variety alcoholic. There's little to nothing I can do for you. You need to go find, you know, and he went out and we know he found the Frank Buckman and the guys from the Oxford Movement. But, everyone tells me, you know, you're an alcoholic. Your only chance of not dying of alcoholism is to have some sort of spiritual awakening. And that, to me, sounds insane. I've been doing this thing for over 6 years. And I'll tell you, my one problem with Alcoholics Anonymous, the one problem I have with AA today, is that the solution that it offers us is very, 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 very impractical. You know, it's hard to swallow. You know, what you guys are offering me, we can dice it up, we can word it up, we can say it a million different ways. What you're offering me is a spiritual solution. You're offering me God to this thing called alcoholism. And a guy like me is not going to engage in a solution that unconventional until I've tried everything else. And I mean everything else. It's not like I'm going to go to rehab once and be like, that didn't work, guess I'm ready to try God now. Okay? I mean, I had to do, you know, and you'll hear in my story later, 3 inpatients, 7 outpatients, every medication you could think of, alcohol blockers, all that stuff, to no avail. until maybe, just maybe, I'm willing to invest in this weird, kooky, goofy 12-step spiritual awakening thing you guys are trying here. You know, a guy like me is not going to invest in something as unconventional as God until I've tried everything else. You know, some of you guys are less hard-headed than me. Maybe it didn't take you 7 years to figure out there's nothing to figure out here. But I needed some convincing. And I'll tell you what, alcohol is a great convincer. It beat me into a state of reasonableness. And I do consider myself one of the lucky few. I don't usually drink this poison. I was saying I'm just getting over this thing the past couple of days. I feel a little worn down, so I apologize if I'm a little... I might not get the best version of me. This is my ego tells me anyway. So, you know, when I got to AA this time, my sponsor sat down with me and he explained alcoholism in a way I had never heard it talked about before. He talked about that powerless with a capital P. And he talked about the spiritual malady and being disconnected. You know, for all those 7 years in and out of AA, I was sure that my problem was the drink. I was sure that I was a problem drinker. And I was sure that if I could just abstain from putting alcohol in the hole in my face for a period of time, that life would get better. That I would be able to exert my will, pull myself up by my bootstraps, forge forward, find a career, find a wife, wake up in the morning, stretch, smile, yawn, and go on with my life. And I was convinced that if I was just able to find a way to stop putting booze in my body, that all that would come together for me. And what he did was he sat down with me and he explained the true nature of alcoholism for the hopeless variety drunk, the spiritual malady, the disconnectedness, the self-centered fear. He talked about this disposition that he had growing up and said he thinks it's something that he had had long before he ever found the drink, something he definitely suffered from while drinking and something he continues to suffer from up until this day. Okay, and the way I see that thing is having a profound lack of perception, that the way I see the world, for whatever reason, does not seem to match reality. You can give me a truckload of evidence that my life is okay and going well and in the right direction, and in my heart, I can find no beauty in the world. I can find no positive aspects of my life. Okay, and my entire life I have lived, and I couldn't have articulated this to you getting here, you know, it's... We find very poetic ways to talk about this stuff now, but when I first got here, I couldn't have told you any of this. But looking back, I lived in this perpetual state of wanting. And I cannot think of a more painful disposition to live on planet Earth than in a perpetual state of wanting. Never, ever, ever being content with the circumstances of my surroundings. Never, ever, ever wanting what it is I have right here, right now. Always constantly wanting what you have, only to fight and exert my will and obtain those things and then want something else. You know, and every day I fight and claw and manipulate and lie in an attempt to line my pockets to the tune of the things that I think are going to complete me inside. And, you know, and I am sure that if I just had X, Y, and Z, I would be happy and whole and complete inside. You know, I wake up in the morning, my alarm goes off, I rub my eyes and I think, crap, it's a day, any day. I'm Lewis, I'm on planet Earth, the money in my wallet's not enough, the money in my bank account's not enough, the college that I went to's not enough, the woman lying next to me, my wife, my girlfriend, whatever, she's not enough, my family's insane. The circumstances of Lewis's life are cruel and unfair, and God is a sick thing out there just poking at me, you know, like an ant with a magnifying glass just toying with me. You know, and, you know, this other thing is that I, right now, not only do I suck in my life, but right now sucks. I have never wanted it to be right now. I've never thought to myself, God, it's just awesome being Sunday night, 6 o'clock at the Blue Mountain Speakers Group, right here, right now. I'm able to see that today. I'm able to sit back and revel in the moment today, but my entire life, and again, I couldn't have articulated to you, I never wanted to be right now. I'm always looking to the future, to a better time, that I'm going to be more calm, more well off, more natural. Everything's going to be okay. Once it's the weekend, everything's going to be great. You know, once it's spring break, I'll be fine. I'll be able to relax. I'll truly be able to cut back. Once it's the summertime, you know, then it'll be nice out and, you know, I won't have seasonal affect disorder and I won't have to work as hard and we get holidays off in the summer, you know, go to the beach. Life will be great. you know, and then it's the summertime and I want a better body, you know. But, you know, when I do the same thing throughout the course of my day, I wake up in the morning, I say, oh, crap, my alarm didn't, I gotta hurry up, gotta get to work, hurry up, let's get out the door, hurry up, brush your teeth, get to work. I'm like, ah, another day at work, come on, let's hurry up, get out of work, let's get out of here, come on, 8 hours, you kidding me, stare, oh, my God, 5 hours, 4 hours, 3 hours, come on, let's get out of here, gotta get to the gym, I'll be great once I get to the gym, I'll have a good workout, I get the endorphins going, let's go work out, I get to the gym, I'm like, oh, God, I don't have the energy today, let's just phone it in, get me out of here, once I get to the meeting, I'm like, this guy's speaking again. Oh, my God. I've heard his story 18 times, and I didn't like it the first 17. Oh, God. An hour. All right. 1 hour. All right. 45 minutes. All right. Half hour. All right. Almost out of here. Okay. You know, God, you know, okay, we're out. And I rush home, and I can't wait to get home. And, you know, I'm watching TV. It'll be great. And I rush my life away. I never sit back and enjoy the moment and smile. Being Lewis sucks right here, right now sucks. So I'm constantly looking to have more and it be later. And I am unable to sit back and enjoy my life for even a minute. Can't get out of here. You know, and I can think of that, you know, and I, like, again, I never would have been able to tell you that. What I would tell you is that I was, you know, my parents sent me to a therapist growing up, that they have been diagnosed with ulcers. I was wound tight. You know, I had problems, you know, and it's funny. I remember being like, I played a lot of sports growing up, and I remember if you get me, I swear no one believes me. But this is a true story. Swear to God. I'm not going to lie from the podium. I am the best basketball player on the face of planet Earth when no one is watching. Okay? And that is when no one is watching and I'm alone and I'm in just whatever, my native natural state, and I'm allowed to just enjoy myself, whatever, a child of God, whatever you want to call me, I am amazing at basketball. And the second anyone else walks into that gymnasium, it could be a 2-year-old child. It could be a 2-year-old blind child, and I have got to look good for this 2-year-old kid. I mean, they've got to know how good I am at basketball. And all of a sudden, I go from this amazing athlete who's having fun, who's just being natural and enjoying himself, to this awkward, contrived thing. You know, and so I think that is another aspect, is that I am desperate for your approval. I'm desperate to have you like me. I'm constantly trying to convince you what I'm sure that I'm not myself. I'm trying to convince you that I'm a man that I'm sure I'm not. You know, and a buddy of mine talked about living in the house that fear built. He said, this right here, this young man in front of you, everything about me is designed and engineered by fear. You know, the way that I walk, the way that I talk, the way that I dress, my haircut, you know, everything about me is designed and engineered so you will not think less of me. It's designed to project a man to the world that is cool. He's confident. He's comfortable. He's happy. He's okay. Because in my heart, I know I'm none of those things. You know, so growing up, I never could have imagined living happy and comfortable on this planet. I thought the best I had to offer you guys was just masking the fear and discomfort from you, and that is what I did. Growing up, I just learned how to hide the fear, mask the fear, mask the discomfort, the awkwardness, all the stuff I've been describing. You know, I think a lot of people sort of go inward and become sort of quiet and read a lot of books. And it was intuitive to me, for whatever reason, to be loud and obnoxious and mean and arrogant. And I think that if I'm those things, you will have no idea how fearful I really am. And so I took it upon myself to just be just loud and obnoxious and in your face. And look at me, you know, but stay away. And just have no idea how truly uncomfortable I am inside, you know, and I became really, really good at that. And when I graduated high school, I won 2 superlatives. I won best personality and I won most outgoing. And I think this is hysterical because I am terrified of you. I am consumed 24 hours a day with what you're thinking about me. Everything about me is a lie and an attempt to gain your friendship and camaraderie and approval. You know, and I don't tell you that to brag or anything. I just tell you that to tell you that I have honed my skills at this point in my life to the point of acting the part of a man who is not desperately terrified and uncomfortable. You know, and so, needless to say, there was a point in my life where I found, you know, relief from the disposition I've been describing. You know, all this up at this point, I'm suffering from untreated alcoholism. And when I was 14 years old, I found a way to treat my alcoholism. And that was with alcohol. You know, and I'm at a party, and my head's chewing on the rest of my body, feeding me bad information, telling me, like, I'm not good enough. Like, I don't know, you ever walk up, like, you know, all your buddies will be standing over here, and everyone's laughing and talking and just, you know, just hanging out, and everyone, ha-ha, funny banter, camaraderie, and you walk up, and you say something, and you try to add your two cents to the ha-ha-ha, but it's not funny. And, like, everyone just stops and looks at you, like, way to ruin the conversation, buddy. Like, I will sit there and think about that all night. Like, that can happen to me once, and I'll sit there all night, like, you shouldn't have said that. Everyone knows how weird you are now. Damn it. Everyone thought you were cool like a half hour ago. Now they know what a loser you really are. And I was, you know, 14 years old, I'm at a party, and my head is just spewing out scenarios faster than I can process them. And I once heard a guy say, I'm not knocking therapy. Therapy is great stuff. You know, he said you can't treat alcoholism with therapy. And he said the reason you can't treat alcoholism with therapy is because my head makes up scenarios, bad scenarios, BS, faster than any therapist could catalog it. It would take a team of therapists 24 hours a day scribbling quick just to catalog all the BS in my mind, let alone treat it. You know what I mean? It's like bringing a knife to a gunfight. It's just, therapy's great stuff, just, in my opinion, not as a treatment for alcoholism. And that's just an opinion, you know. Probably not in our literature. But, you know, and so I'm sitting there, and my head's just chewing on me, and I get a little bit of the Mad Dog 2020 in me, and it wasn't the first time I drank, but it was the first time the magic happened for me. And I'm sitting there, and I just, all sorts of, is that one kid gonna come that you were mouthing off to today? Is that girl you like, is she gonna show up? That comment you said before, that wasn't funny. You know, do you look a little chubby in this little champion sweatshirt? You know, like, 14 years old, I don't have a mortgage, I don't pay child support, I don't pay taxes, the IRS isn't looking for me, I don't have to worry about promotions, jobs, bosses, families. I'm 14, you know? I'm sitting there just going crazy in my head. And for the first time in my life, I get some Mad Dog in me and all that. I wanted what I had. That's the easy way to describe it. For the first time in my life, I didn't want to be you. I didn't want your body. I didn't want your car. I didn't want your income. I didn't want your girlfriend. I wanted to be exactly who I was, where I was. Well, I was okay. First time in my life, I was like, I'm okay doing exactly what I'm doing, where I'm doing, how I'm doing it. If anybody in here has a problem with what I'm doing, where I'm doing, and how I'm doing it, you can go jump up at Duck's Behind. You know? That's fine with me. I was okay with exactly who and what Lewis was. You know, the same thing I think God has offered me today is the same thing that alcohol offered me then, was being okay with who and what Lewis is. You know, and you know, that night I just remember I was great. You know, and again, I couldn't have articulated any of this to you. I wake up the next day, I don't know about anyone else, I'm in and out of here for 7 years. People know I'm trying to get sober. Friends, family, girlfriends. Hurting people, stealing from people, paying horrible prices, losing opportunities time and time and time again. And I think I'm a bad guy. I think I'm a horrible, horrible man. I'm a weak-willed man. I'm an evil man. I'm a malicious man. That I keep doing the things that I've done, hurting people the way that I have, paying the prices that I have, lying to family members and girlfriends over and over and over again. I'm a piece of garbage, you know, and I know today I am not a malicious man. I am not an evil man. I'm probably, you know, not even a weak-willed man. You know, I never once in my life woke up in the morning and thought to myself, how do I hurt my family today? How do I make my family cry today? How do I make my girlfriend cry today? How do I hurt the people that love me most? Never once had that thought. I wake up every day faced with a decision. To be Lewis or to be okay. You know, and for me, that is a no-brainer. I don't know how else to live. I don't know how else to breathe. My first 14 years of my life, I walked around incredibly jammed up, self-centered, not enjoying my life, hard to breathe, hands clammy, uncomfortable right here, right now. And suddenly that night, I had discovered the keys to the kingdom. You know, the world was my playground. The world was my oyster. And I woke up the next morning. It's not everyone's experience, but it's mine that I became a daily drinker from jump. You know, I woke up the next day and I was faced with that decision. I can be Lewis or I can be okay again today. And I could never fathom, you know, I didn't know then that people just maybe liked to drink but didn't have what I had. Because I couldn't fathom, like, if alcohol made me feel the way that it made me feel that night, why wouldn't I feel that way always? If we're going to go hiking, why wouldn't we drink and go hiking? If we're going whitewater rafting, why wouldn't we drink and go white? Why would I go to school and not drink? Why would I play baseball and not drink? Why would I do anything and not drink? Drinking makes everything better. It allows me to breathe deeply. It makes it okay to be Lewis right here, right now. It curbs my spiritual malady. It's great stuff, you know? And I just could never fathom why normal people would, like, go to school and not drink when going to school was so much more fun when you're drinking. And, you know, and so I became a daily drinker from Jump Street, you know. And it wasn't because I was a bad man. It wasn't because I was an evil man. It wasn't because I was even a weak-willed man. It was because I desperately needed the relief that came in that bottle. I didn't know any other way to live. I didn't know any other way to breathe. You know, and so I will sum up the next couple years of my story in a very few succinct statements. If you guys want more details, I'm happy to share them with you afterwards. But we all pretty much have the same story. Over the next 7 years, I pretty much lost everything a human being can lose. I did 3 inpatient rehabs. I did 7 outpatient rehabs. I wrecked 3 cars. I dropped out of college a handful of times. I lost a girlfriend of 5.5 years, the woman that I was hoping to marry. I had nothing to do with my family for years at a time. Changed the locks, you know, blocked my phone number, immediate and extended family, cut off from, you know. I have done some overnights in jail. I've ended up in hospitals with IVs in my neck and body. I've sold all of my belongings. You know, I've run the gamut of alcoholic living. I can go on and on and on with this kind of stuff. I'm a low bottom drunk. I'm from Baltimore originally, so you can imagine. You know, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. I talk about alcoholism. You know, for me, that's alcohol and everything that goes along with it. And it's all anti-Lewis medication. I don't know, up, down, sideways. I don't even care. You know. And you, it's funny, like, people are like, did you just drink? You didn't do anything else? You just drank? I'm like, I'm from Baltimore. I don't even think that's allowed. I don't even think they let you do that there. So, I pretty much lost everything that a human being can lose. And I've heard, you know, conjecture in Alcoholics Anonymous. Did I lose it? Did I give it away? I don't know. What I know is those are prices I'm happy to pay for the relief that comes in that bottle. You know, family, God, I love you guys. You've done an amazing job raising me. You've never done anything but love me and support me and guide me. I will miss you. Bye. You know, girlfriend, God, I love you more than any girl I've ever known. I'll probably, maybe to this day, you know, I don't know if I'll ever find anyone quite like you. Bye. You know, and frankly, when she left, half of me wanted to cry and the other half of me was like, to lie anymore. I don't have to constantly con and scheme, and the second she gets out the door, scramble, and, you know, it's not a constant act and manipulation and scam. At least I can do what I want in peace now. Don't have to constantly lie about everything. You know, drop out of school, stuff like that. Yeah, that's fine. You know, sell all my belongings. Happy to do that. Happy to do that. Sleep outside? No problem. All for the relief that comes in that bottle. And again, just because being Lewis is so terrifying that I'm happy to pay whatever price I have to for the relief that comes in that bottle. And I can paint a very vivid picture to you. If you give me 2 options tonight, say I'm suffering from alcoholism, active alcoholism right now, and the monster's on me, okay? Monster's on your back. And you say to me, Lewis, you can stay in the Hyatt Hotel tonight in the nicest suite we have, the presidential suite with unlimited room service, goose down, pillow comforters, bedspreads, you know, 60 million thread cotton sheets, whatever, Egyptian cotton, you know, pay-per-view, you know, jacuzzi, you know, nicest room that you guys could imagine. You know, you just have to be alone, and you're not allowed to have any alcohol. you know. Or you can sleep in this park bench over here in central Baltimore, and it's you can have Jim Beam, Jack, Johnny Daniels, Jack, Jose Cuervo, all your buddies, you know. I will take the bench every time. You know, well, I'll tell my buddies, hey, we're going camping tonight. You know, we're gonna go sleep out on this park. Those are prices I'm happy to pay. It's a no-brainer for me. It's not even, if you gave me those two options when I was drinking, I wouldn't even need 10 seconds to answer that. I wouldn't even need 5 seconds to answer that question. I don't even need 2 seconds to answer that question. Put me on the bench, give me the booze, now. You know, I desperately need that relief. That hotel room is scary. You know, I wake up in a world I don't recognize that's threatening and evil, that's dry and desolate, that's terrifying. I don't want to be in that hotel room by myself. I'd rather be on the park bench with the booze. You know, and so over the course of those 7 years, in and out of these rooms, I paid those prices. And I'll tell you what, I'm happy to do it for that relief. And I'll tell you, the scary prospect is that at a very young age for me, the relief that I started to get from booze was starting to wax and wane. And it didn't seem to matter. I could physically get drunk, but I couldn't shut this up all the time. And that is terrifying. The one solution for living I had found when I was 14 years old didn't always work now, and was starting to work less and less. And it didn't matter how drunk I got, sometimes my head was still chewing on me. And I'm like, no, I didn't sign up for this. I sold my soul to the devil to shut this up. Okay, you're not allowed to talk in my ear. I pay a lot of prices for your relief. You're going to shut up. You're going to do what you're supposed to do. Okay, and I felt betrayed and angry, but most of all, terrified. Terrified. The one solution I have for life isn't always working now. And that is a terrifying prospect for a guy like me. I'll tell you, the other terrifying prospect is, as it says, professionals send us to AA. Drunks wash up on our shores every day. They tell you, if you don't want to die, go to AA. And I think to myself, I've been to AA. Doesn't work. Those people are psycho. I've sat in their chairs. I'll tell you, there's not a more scary or lonely place than coming to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for years and watching people get sober while you're dying. And you tell yourself, I've done what they've done, and it doesn't work. You know, I knew today I had not done what they've done because I hadn't gone through the 12 steps. I, for 7 years, came to a 12-step fellowship, but somehow neglected to go through the 12 steps. It's really weird. This thing didn't work for me. I'm a slow learner. And, you know, one of the most succinct things I think I have ever heard in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I think we could talk for the next 50 hours about AA and its dogma and its history and the 12 steps and the tenets contained within. You know, I heard summed up by a woman, and she said to me, AA is not for people who want it, and it's not for people who need it. It's for people who do it. And I was just like, okay, how do you argue with that? You know, so when I woke up on June 3rd, 2006, it was like every other morning. You know, our book talks about these four horsemen, this terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. I've always said I hate those four words. And the reason that I hate those four words is because they are just words. Because there are not words in the English language or any other language, as far as I'm concerned, that can describe the pain that I wake up in every morning. And there's a line from Ocean's 11 where Brad Pitt asked George Clooney, he goes, "You suicidal?" And Clooney goes, "Only in the mornings." And I understand that. You know, I wake up in the morning and the first thing I do is I cry. You know, I cry some days before I open my eyes. And I cry because I'm me. Because I'm suffering from untreated alcoholism, because no matter where I go, no matter what I do, no matter who I call, no matter what plan of action I execute for sobriety today, I cannot stop pouring booze in the hole in my face. I am a slave. I have no choice. And it's been that way for a long time. And I wake up every day with the most sincere desire to get sober a man can have. I wake up crying and shaking and shivering with fluids coming out of everywhere, lying in my bed, and I say, I'm going to do it today. I'm going to change today. I'm going to pick myself up today. It stops today. No more. okay? And what I do is I put every physical, tangible roadblock I can think of between me and the next drink. And what that looks like for a guy like me is I call my family and I say, guys, I love you and I miss you so much and I'm so sorry for everything I've done and I'm about to get sober. Everything's about to change. I'm sorry. And I call the girlfriend and I say, I'm about to get sober. I'm so sorry. You know, I'm going to change. You're going to see. It's going to be different. And, you know, and I call my roommates. I'm the worst roommate ever. I don't know if anybody's ever been an alcoholic roommate or lived with an alcoholic roommate, but I'm the kind of roommate that eats all of your Frosted Flakes and then piles up the dirty dishes in my room and leaves them in there and then urinates in your dirty dishes because I can't make the way to the bathroom, so I just, like, urinate in glasses and bowls in my room. I'm not making this up. This is true stuff. So I eat your food, leave your dirty dishes in my room, urinate in your dishes, and then try to fight you when you come into my room and ask me why there's urine in your dishes. This is the kind of roommate I am. And so needless to say, I'm not a very good roommate. I haven't, you don't want me moving in with you. And you know, I go to the roommates and I tell them, I'm about to get sober. I'm so sorry for the way I've been acting. I'm so sorry for being late with rent. I'm so sorry for eating all your food. I'm so sorry for leaving the house a mess. I'm sorry for trying to fight you the other day. It's going to change. I promise. It's, you know, different stuff. It's going to change. Maybe I call my friends. I ask them to hold my money. Say, look, I'm going to need you guys to help me. I'm going to need your support. I'm going to need you to talk me off the ledge the next couple of weeks. I'm going to need you to babysit me. I'm going to need you to hold my money for me. Maybe I'll call some drug dealers and I'll say, Mr. Drug Dealer, I'm no longer going to be doing any drugs and I'd appreciate it if you would no longer sell me any drugs. That would be great. Thank you very much. No longer going to be needing your services. Thank you. And stuff like that. Maybe I'll call my old alcohol counselors and I'll tell them, hey, look, I'm about to get sober. I'm going to need your help again. Maybe you guys could help me with some detox medication, maybe some therapy, maybe some group therapy. I don't know. I'm going to need your help. I call the members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Hey, remember me? Look, I'm thinking about coming back. I'm going to need some help. I don't know what I'm doing here. Can you guys please help me? And then maybe I lock myself in my bedroom. Maybe I lock the door, slide the key into the door, nail some 2x4s in the door, lock myself in there, tell my roommates, don't let me out of this room. And I get in bed, and I shake like a twig, and I watch one episode of Judge Judy, and I watch one episode of The Price is Right, and I get up and I go drink. Every day. Sometimes I'll make it till 10, sometimes I'll make it till 11, sometimes I'll make it till noon, maybe once, twice a year I'll make it till nighttime. But every single day I get up and I go drink. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Every day I wake up with the most sincere desire to get sober a man can have, telling you I would sell my soul to God or Satan to just not drink today. And if I would pass a polygraph test, if I called all those people and told them I was getting sober and we're going to do this today. And every day I'm drunk by noon, you know. And that's why I wake up and I cry. And the reason I can articulate that to you guys that vividly is because that hasn't happened to me once or twice or a dozen times. That has happened to me day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year for about a decade straight. Groundhog's Day. Every day waking up desperately wanting to be different, feeling like I'm shaving a little bit of my soul off every day, and every day I drink. You know, and the people that love us most, don't you know you're dying? Don't you know you're dying? Don't you know you're killing yourself? Can't you see what you're doing? And I smile at such a Sally, you know. I laugh in your face because you don't get it. Death? Death sounds amazing. Death sounds great. Death sounds like sweet relief. You know, I'm being dragged on my face by the tractor trailer of life on a gravel road for 10 years straight. And you're telling me you're going to die, and that's supposed to scare me. That sounds amazing. I pray for the end, you know, and so I woke up that morning, and I'm lying in bed, and I'm crying, and the only thing I think that was different about that morning is that I was thoroughly convinced, beyond a shadow of a doubt, if it was a way to get sober on planet Earth, I didn't know it. I didn't have the information. I didn't have the willpower. I didn't have it. Whatever it was, it wasn't coming out of his head. You know, that's the only thing I knew that morning. And I woke up, and this is the really cliche part of my story. I tell you, I woke up and I went downstairs. I was living in Baltimore City in a neighborhood called Hamden. And I always tell people, if you can get sober in Hamden, you can get sober anywhere. And I'm downstairs, and I'm sitting on my back porch, and I'm watching the sun come up, and I'm smoking a cigarette. I'm just shaking and twitching and crying. And I said a prayer to a God I didn't believe in. You know, and I heard people say stuff like this for years at the podium, and I thought to myself, you are so sick and deluded. You believe in a fairy tale God. I always wanted proof. You want proof? We are the proof. We're a group of 30, 40 alcoholics sitting in a room. The most natural thing in the world for us to do right now is to drink alcohol, and yet we're somehow sitting here sober, happy about it. A buddy of mine, she always says, the miracle isn't that I don't drink today. The miracle is that I don't want to, you know. And so I get up that morning and I said a prayer to a God I didn't believe in, and it was a very colorful prayer to the effect of, God, if you're friggin' out there, please friggin' help me because I'm friggin' dying here and I need your friggin' help. And I sat there just twitching and leaning and bouncing and bobbing and moving all over the place, crying and smoking for a good hour or two, just saying the word please over and over and over again. Please, please, you know, please. And I believe that day is the day that God's grace entered my life. You know, a gift that cannot be earned and is not warranted. You know, and an intuitive thought came over me and said, go to an AA meeting. And I got up and I went to a meeting and I stood up and I said, you know, my name's Lewis, I'm an alcoholic and I can't get sober. If anybody in this room has anything they can do, anything they can tell me about sobriety, I'll do it. I'll listen. I'm done. I woke up that morning and I gave myself an ultimatum. This sounds really dramatic, especially from the podium. I gave myself an ultimatum. I said, today, I'm either going to get sober or I'm going to kill myself. But one way or the other, it ends here. And I could care less which way it went. I mean, literally, it was like the decision between putting on a left sock versus a right sock. If I get sober today, great, win. If I don't, great, win, I'm done. I could have cared less. And I just said, but whatever happens, I'm never waking up feeling this way ever again. Ever. I don't care. I'm done. I give up. And I asked for help at that meeting, and you guys did what you do. You came up to me, and you put your hand out, and you offered me what it was you had. You know, and I went to another meeting, and I asked for help again right after that. Lewis, drunk, can't get sober. Somebody please help me. And once again, you came and you offered the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous to me. And I finally was beaten into a state of reasonableness, that willingness born of desperation, where I maybe was willing to listen to what you guys were talking about here. There's a saying in Baltimore, which is a horrible, horrible saying. We have a lot of really bad stuff out there. I don't know if it's like that out here, but I don't know who makes this stuff up. It's certainly not in our literature. But it says, people always say, take what you want and leave the rest. I mean, I don't know what that equates to a really sick alcoholic like me. I was like, can I take the women and leave the rest? I don't know. Like, is that okay? Are we allowed to do that? Take what you want and leave the rest. Man, I left most of what you guys were talking about here, and you know, and so that day I was, like I said, I had no delusions that whatever it took to get sober, I didn't know it, and I asked you guys for help. And so very early on, I got sober on a Sunday, and so it was a Tuesday. It was 3 days later. I heard a man speaking at a meeting, and he wasn't the lead of the meeting. He simply got called on and spoke for 5 minutes. Now, he did not know that that was the most important meeting of my life. You know, I don't believe that first meeting coming into AA was the most important meeting of my life. I believe that meeting was, because I heard a man stand up and talk about a solution. And the first thing he did is he stood up and he identified. I couldn't even tell you who led that meeting. I couldn't tell you what anyone else said at that meeting. I just know that this man stood up and folded his arms and was at peace and ease and was self-effacing. And he described alcoholism. He described my mind perfectly. I think we do a lot of stuff here to help alcoholics. I don't know about you guys. I've written checks for alcoholics, which is, I think, the least effective thing we do here to help anybody. I have never once written an alcoholic a check, and that ended well. You know, I think, you know, rides, stuff like that are great, you know, but I think the one thing that we have to offer each other here that is unparalleled is hope. You know, that man gave me hope that night. He described my head perfectly. He described my thinking perfectly. He described my childhood perfectly. My disposition, the self-centered fear, the spiritual malady. He described it all. And everything about him shouted, his entire deportment shouted, I have a solution. I don't feel that way today. He didn't tell me I'm an attorney. He didn't tell me, you know, I have a lot of friends. He didn't tell me I make a lot of money. He said I'm sober today and happy about it. I didn't care about any of that other stuff, you know? And I went up to him after the meeting and I asked him for help. And he said, sure. He said, do you have some time to talk? And I said, that's all I have, man. If you'd have asked me for 35 cents, I'd have been like, sorry, but time? Yeah, I got some time. I got some of that. And he took me to the side then and there, and he talked to me about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, about our predecessors, about Carl Jung, Roland Hazard, Evie Thatcher, the Oxford Movement. He talked to me about the importance of one alcoholic working with another and how he believed that both his sobriety and our sobriety, that everything we do here hinged on one alcoholic working with another, how it seems to work when all other things fail. And that was music to my ears because all other things had failed for me. You know, and I once heard a guy talk who said he knew Bill Wilson and was friends with Bill, and people would go up to Bill and say, God, Bill, that, you know, you can imagine, he was, you know, I guess like a prophet. Like, we all know that Bill had his shortcomings, but people looked at him as a prophet and they cried to him, thank you. You've changed my life. You've changed my family's life. You've saved us. You don't know what you've done for my husband. You don't know what you've done for my son, my daughter. You've saved us. Thank you so much. And he never said, oh no, I didn't do anything. Oh no, thank God. He never said any of that. All he ever said was, pass it on. You know, that's all he ever said. All the praise, all the glory that people tried to throw at him, all he ever said was, pass it on. And that's what this man was doing. You know, I'm sure that some of his buddies would have loved to have shot the stuff with him out in the parking lot and laughed and hung out and had fun. And he was exercising a primary purpose. I'm sure that there were some young ladies looking for his attention that night and trying to flirt with him in the parking lot. He was exercising a primary purpose. You know, I'm sure there was people looking for his attention and hanging out with him. And he knew enough about what we do here to pull aside a new guy and to talk to him about alcoholism. And he saved my life, you know. And he said to me, I believe that, you know, it's funny. I asked him to sponsor me, and his response to that amazed me to this day. The humility, you know, and the humble nature he came at this thing with. And I needed that because I was so pompous when I came here. And I said, hey, will you be my sponsor? And he said to me, I'll tell you what I'll do. He said, I don't care if you call me your sponsor, your brother, your friend. Why don't you just go through the 12 steps with me? So the word sponsor means nothing to me. I said, sure, I'll sponsor you. I don't care what you call me, though. Go through the 12 steps with me from beginning to end to the best of your ability. And he said, I believe that all I am is a power cord. I believe my job is to walk down this path with you in one hand and God in the other and show you this deal. And at the end of that, I think my job is to teach you how to transmit this to other men. Same principle of take a man fishing for a day, feed him for a day. Teach him how to fish, feed him for a lifetime. He said, I could get you fired up through the 12 steps and maybe you'd have a spiritual awakening, catch a little fire for this thing, or I could teach you how to transmit this to other men and show you how to stay sober long term. And you know, he asked me if I believed in God and I said, absolutely not. I want nothing to do with God. And he said, you know, well, I'll tell you what. I believe that this is a set of principles. And if you'd asked me early on, I didn't know what a principle was. And I'm like, oh yeah, principles, spiritual principles. Practice these principles in all our... principles. Yeah, I know that. And I didn't know what a principle was. And he said to me, a principle is something that applies to all men equally, like gravity. It's a principle. Gravity doesn't care if you believe it or not, if you understand it or not, if you agree with it or not, if you know the physical equation for it. It applies to you just like every other man, woman, and child on this planet. And he said, in a similar way, there's a set of principles in this literature, spiritual in nature, that expel the desire to drink alcohol and leave us usefully whole. And he said, and the reason I tell you that is because I don't care if you believe in God or not. I don't care if you understand God. I don't care if you agree with me. Do it to prove me wrong. Do it to laugh in our faces. but do it. He said, I don't care why you do it. If it's a principle, as long as you do it, you will get the same results that I've gotten and that my predecessors have gotten. And I couldn't argue with that. So I said, okay. And so what happened, you know, what happened was, you know, what I'm here to tell you tonight, what the message is that I went through the 12 steps to prove you clowns wrong. You know, I couldn't wait to go through this process and still be drunk and suicidal. I was going to laugh in your face, say, well, there's my confirmation. I knew you guys were a cult. I knew you were psycho. Ha, ha, ha. I'm going to kill myself now. And, you know, and thank God that's not what happened to me. You know, I went through the 12 steps to prove you guys wrong, and my desire to drink was removed. You know, I don't know how that happens. I can't explain that to anybody. You know, it's weird. People outside, like, God, it must be so hard not to drink. You must have great willpower, and I don't even bother. Because you're just like, hey, well, God sort of did this thing to me, and I don't know. I just don't want to drink today. You know, I something happened to me, and my desire to drink was removed. You know, and I think I suffer from alcoholism at times. I act out alcoholically at times. I can use darn near anything alcoholically. Vanity, money, job, gambling, food. You know, I can use things alcoholically. But for whatever reason, since going through this process, the drink has never once presented itself as a solution to my problems. People have died. Family catastrophes, horrible things have happened in my sobriety because that's life. And never once has the drink whispered into my ear, I can fix this. I can make this better. You know, trust me. And I believe I've been placed in that position of neutrality it talks about in the 10th step, safe and protected. I haven't even sworn off. The problem has been removed so long as I remain in fit spiritual condition. Now, that's pretty impressive stuff as far as I was concerned. I wanted the proof. Here we are. You know, but I think more impressive than that is somewhere around my 4th and 5th steps, some started to happen to me. The way that I saw the world started to change. Our book describes it as a spiritual experience. You know, and if you're sitting in this room and you know what I'm talking about, you know what I'm talking about. You know, there's not a whole lot of words I can really use to describe it. I've heard people say it's like, you know, going from black and white to color. You know, I've heard people saying, hey, I was able to see past my own nose for the first time. But there really aren't maybe necessarily great words to describe it. What I can say is that something happened to me and the way that I saw the world changed. My place in the world changed. My view of myself changed. And for the first time in my life, I wanted what I had. I was okay being sober and being Lewis and being here right now. I was okay with that. And I think what part of that was, I think maybe that was a couple fold, I think part of that was, is that as far as I was concerned, my entire life, you guys, by you guys I don't mean alcoholics, I mean human beings, you guys are enemy combatants. Okay? You are not on my friggin' team. It is me versus you in a fierce competition for resources. And I have always felt that way. You know, and I have rooted for your demise. And when good things happen to you, I feel threatened and insecure. You know, and when Sam here gets a good job and gets a promotion at work, I hate Sam. You know, I'm smarter than him. How could he get that job? Are you kidding? What about mine? He's making more money than me. I did better than him in school growing up. How could this be? How could this possibly be? You know, or maybe you get a pretty girlfriend or a nice wife, and I'm like, what? I'm sitting here alone and by myself, and you got a wife? Like, she didn't even come flirt with me before she just settled with you and married you? Like, how could this be? You know, and then the flip side of that, when you get fired or lose your job, I'm secretly like, yes. The rest of the world found out what I already knew. You're a loser. You know, no, I'm not you, of course, but, you know, and I have this, for whatever this awkward, we are all on this totem pole of life. We are all stacked up on top of one another, and the second you get a good job, you just pop one rung above me, and my ego just can't take that, and I hate you. You know, and when something bad happens to you, and you're under me in that totem pole of life, I'm like, yes, that's what I'm talking about. You know, and I have seen you guys as the enemy my whole life, trying to take, you know, always thinking my problem is not enough for Lewis and my solution is more for Lewis. And all I've ever seen you guys as is a roadblock in me obtaining the things that are going to make me truly happy. Money, power, prestige. And what the tenets of the 12 steps explain to me is that you are on my team. Is that you are my brothers and sisters, children of God, just like me, no better, no worse. You know, just another lost, confused, scared mammal trying to make it through this weird, crazy life. And trying to do the best they can. You know, and I found out that it is in my best interest to harbor love and growth and happiness in you. That I think, I don't know what our job is here, but AA has given me a job, and what I think that is to nudge my brothers and sisters towards God. You know, when I got here, thank God, I had a sponsor who said to me, Lewis, we don't sponsor people here, we nudge people towards God. I don't care if you're friggin' sponsoring guys in AA. I'm talking in AA, out of AA, at work, with your family, with the people you're dating. Are you nudging people towards God? You know, it is the wisdom of the ages and the tenets of every single Judeo-Christian Muslim religion at the core is, I am my brother's keeper. It is my job to help you grow, to help you be better. And in doing so, something happens. Something cathartic, something healing. Call it the God in me touching the God in you. It's something the Oxford movement figured out long before we did. It's something Bill and Bob figured out in the 30s. And it's something that's proliferated out of that with millions of people all across the world. One person sitting down with another for free and for fun, sharing love. And something healing happens. You know, and my spirit awoke. You know, I caught fire for this thing. And it was amazing. You know, and I think that part of the reason I don't want to drink today is because there's nothing to treat with the drink. If I'm treating my malady with God and service, what is there to treat with the drink? What is there to run from? What is there to fear? What is there to seek relief from? And I drove down here to Virginia, and I was alone in my car, and I was fine with it. I love my alone time. I was a guy who hated being. I love being alone today. It's great. A bunch of the guys I sponsor had other stuff going on tonight, and I dragged them all on a road trip yesterday. I was like, no, I'll go. I'll triage out phone calls. It's great. Stay home. Go to another meeting. It's great. I'm happy about that. You know, but I will say this. I think it's easy to sound sober from a podium of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to shut up in a minute. I think it's easy to sound sober from the podium. I think it's easy to stand up here and be like, look at me. I'm really sober. This is my experience. You know, but I'll tell you what. The truth is I still suffer from untreated alcohol. I mean, not untreated. I still suffer from alcoholism to this day. You know, and at times I pull up at a red light next to a man in an Audi R8 with a beautiful wife and clearly a lot of money, and I think to myself, lack of Audi is my dilemma. You know, lack of model wife is my dilemma. Lack of seven-figure income is my dilemma. If I just had that, I would be so happy and whole and free inside. In sobriety. If I just had that job, I'd be so happy. And I will fight and I will claw and I will manipulate. And I will step away from AA. And I will step away from God. And I will step away from my sponsorship. And I will step away from the fellowship. And you know why I will do this? Because I'm human. Because every one of us have done this and every one of us will do this again. I can promise you that. You know, I'm human. I'm going to fall short. And I step away from this thing, and every single time, one of two things happens. Either I don't hit the mark. I don't get the thing. I don't get the job. I don't get the bonus, the raise, the girlfriend, the car. I don't get it. And I feel alone and afraid and empty and scared inside. Or maybe the flip side of that happens. Maybe I do hit the mark. Maybe I do get the job. Maybe I do get the girl. Maybe I do get it. And I feel alone and afraid and empty and scared inside. The outcome is irrelevant. When I step away from you guys and God for the purpose of self-seeking, I feel alone. I'm in a desert. I can find no beauty in the world. It's a scary place. And every single one of those times, I'm faced with a decision. Grow or drink. Grow or drink. Grow or drink. The men I look up to here and the men that have the experience that I want here, the women too, you know, are the people that have been willing to grow, people have been willing to face adversity, and charge forward, sort of with God in one hand and his brothers and sisters in the other. So you guys have given me an amazing design for living, and I love this thing. So thanks for letting me share.